The Bane Free Radio Hour.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Bane Free Radio Hour. I am your podcast host, David Afshirod, and I'm here with Catherine Asaro. She is the author of the Skolian Empire novels, as well as the Major Bajan series, and now the Dust Knight series. And we'll talk about how those little Russian nesting dolls all work with those series. But we are specifically here to talk about her new novel, The Down Deep, which is out now in hardcover. Catherine, thanks so much for coming on the Bane Free Radio Hour.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
So I kind of alluded to the fact that you are the author of three series that Bane publishes, but also there's sort of one series in a way. So can you kind of set up this larger world of the Skolian Empire, and then how the Major Bajan books fit in, and then how this new novel, The Down Deep, sort of is a continuation of that, but in a maybe a little bit of a different direction?
Yeah, exactly. The Skolian Empire, I actually didn't name it that. I had thought of calling it the Ruby, you know, Tales of the Ruby Dynasty. But by the time that occurred to me, my previous publisher had already decided on Skolian Empire. So it's tales revolving around several generations of a family that was once the ruling family. You know, millennia ago, they were a dynasty that ruled an empire. Now it's a modern day, an elected assembly, you know, runs things. But they still, because of certain things that they can do genetically that are difficult to reproduce, you can't even clone them or anything. Their abilities, they have certain neurological abilities that make them vital to running ancient machines from the empire that had collapsed millennia ago. So a lot of it revolves around attempts as they're trying to get this young civilization going, how they interact with this family. Because on the one hand, they have absolutely no power at all. On the other hand, the modern civilization needs them to make things from the ruins of the ancient civilization work and to figure it all out. Why doesn't this work? Why can't we get, you know, more people who can help us? That sort of thing. So they're very valuable, but at the same time, very marginalized simultaneously. And a lot of it is stories of different characters in that empire. The characters all come from this family. And so a lot of those books are standalone, but they all tell tales of this dynasty, the Ruby Dynasty. So that's the what you refer to as a Skolian Empire series. And it is known by that now, by almost everyone. That actually takes place later in the chronology of this universe I created. I've created a whole thing with other planets and all sorts of various establishments and families. The Major Bajan books take place much earlier. It overlaps a little bit with the earliest stages of the modern dynasty, that is, with the parents who gave birth to all these kids, and they had a lot of kids. And most of the stories in the Skolian Empire have to do with their kids. Major Bajan mysteries don't actually have anything to do with that. Major Bajan is a character from the Undercity, which is a very impoverished, and yet it's simultaneously a very impoverished culture, but a beautiful, you know, almost secret culture that very few people have access to. She comes from them, and she was able to get out. She joined the military and spent 20 years in the military. When she retired, she became a PI, private investigator. So she's really good at problem solving. She was put on retainer by the most powerful family on this planet, Raelicon, which doesn't actually figure, except a vague reference every now and then in the Skolian Empire series. You know, but other than that, it doesn't really figure in that series at all. And the people that are in the Major Bajan series very rarely, you know, every now and then you get a reference to someone who did come from the other books. But, you know, Major Bajan is meeting them just like the reader's meeting them. So really, it has absolutely no dependence on the Skolian Empire. So it's completely separate from that. It's about Major Bajan solving mysteries. Usually, they're all murder mysteries in the classic whodunit sense.
Yeah.
But they're science fictional. And she does it, she solves this for this powerful family because she can go places nobody else can because of her connection to the Undercity. However, after I wrote a few books in that series, I realized I was really constrained. I started getting interested in the other characters, and they all had stories. And the Dust Knights were actually a group, a martial arts group she started for kids as a way to help them. You know, she's trying to help give forward to her people so that they can, you know, climb out of poverty and get things to help them have better lives without sacrificing this beautiful culture they have. So the Dust Knights started to develop in the books, and they went from being a martial arts group that she started for young people to a group of very highly dedicated protectors for the Undercity, you know, adults. And instead of just teaching them, you know, martial arts as a way to, you know, give these kids a center, they became very good at it. And they started reaching out to the rest of the planet, the civilization on that planet that mostly had ignored them up to now, to develop, you know, like to get their black belts. They're making connections. And that's when I realized this is completely different stories. Mm-hmm. You know, I was telling the Major Bajan mysteries first person from Major Bajan's point of view. These were not that. They were not murder mysteries. They were not whodunits. And I wanted to start bringing in more of what the other characters were doing and thinking. And that's what I did. That's why the Dust Knight starts as a new series. You don't have to have read the Major Bajan mysteries to you know, jump right in with book one. And I deliberately wrote it that way. If you have, you'll recognize a lot of what's going on, certainly, but you don't have to at all have read it. So the first one, The Down Deep, which we're talking about today, does involve a lot of Major Bajan. I'm working on the second one now, you'll be happy to know. And she's not in it anywhere near as much. So it's much more focused on the Dust Knights, and some of them are being recruited to join the Olympic track and field team for the planet. And this is huge because there's never been interaction between the haves and the have-nots before. So the new stories deal with that. They're not, you know, mysteries anymore.
Well, great. So the you know, there's definitely sounds like, you know, I think we have up on the Bane website for some of the series, like where to start in chronologies. And I think what sounds like is nice about these books is, and certainly I came on as the editor of the Down Deep, and I had read some of the others, but this was the first one I edited. And so I think I agree with you. You can jump in here. You can read the Major Bajan books, or like you were saying, the earlier Scholian Empire. So there's a lot of points of entry to this series, which I think makes it great for readers. You know, you don't have to go track down the first one. And you know, sometimes that can feel like homework, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think, you know, you've given people an opportunity to really jump in wherever they'd like. So I'm going to steal listeners to the podcast. Griffin Barber does a lot of our interviews, and I love the way he approaches them. So Griffin, I'm going to steal some of your shtick here. So he always asks, and I would like to ask you, what to you is the coolest thing about The Down Deep, the book?
Oh, gosh. Well, since I wrote it, obviously, I enjoyed a lot of it. I think one of the parts I particularly enjoyed was developing the culture of this place called the Down Deep. You know, it's different from the Undercity, which is the civilization where a lot of the other books take place. The Undercity is below the desert. It's in the ruins of an ancient civilization, which itself is kind of a mystery because they aren't sure if humans built this 5,000 years ago, how much of it was already there, who did build it, if not humans. But they're living in these gorgeous underground ruins. The Down Deep is even below that. They're still living in ruins, but they're not the same as the ones in the Undercity. And a few times I referred to it in the Major Bajan mysteries, and I think there was one or two scenes where, maybe one scene in one of them, where she actually went there. What's interesting in terms of her character is there is some question, does she have hereditary from the down deep? Well, you never know in the major Bajan mysteries, but you might find out in the new series. But that was fun for me, developing the world building for that,
yeah,
that culture.
Well, I loved, you know, science fiction with famously the sense of wonder. And you really, while this is, you know, in some ways very gritty human stories that you're telling, that sort of, it was so evocative in those ruins. And just, I love the way, you know, like you say, we don't really get answers, but things are hinted at with where those came from and how long people have been there. So I also thought that was a very cool part. Again, this is another Griffin Barber question. And maybe the answer is, maybe it's obvious, maybe it's not. He said, so if you were in this world, which character would you most want to have on your side in a fight? You
know, Major Baja.
Yeah, okay.
No doubt about that. Yeah. You know, people ask me, well, are you Major Bajan? And I have to say, absolutely, I couldn't be. Uh-huh. Because she is like 6 feet tall and strong, and she's like a 6-degree black belt in their martial arts. And, you know, she has all these abilities, and she was a major in the army, and she's, you know, brilliant and all these things. And, you know, I'm a very small, rather petite, you know, vulnerable person who the one time I took a martial arts class, they got frustrated with me because I was afraid to punch because I was afraid to hurt someone. You know, like, so I'm absolutely not Major Bajan, but I think there are a lot of aspects of my personality in her. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a fighter. I am too. She had to fight to succeed despite all the odds against her. And, you know, I've kind of had that a lot in my life. You know, I was a woman in theoretical physics when there are almost no other women. I was often the only woman in the class. Back then, it was perfectly accepted for professors to say things like, you know, make derogatory comments or dismissive. Perhaps dismissive is a better word. And so I had to fight a lot to prove myself. And I also came from, you know, a high school that people didn't think of as the type that would send students to places like Harvard, you know, that sort of thing. And so, you know, I had to prove myself, you know, for a long time. So there's a lot of me in her. I'm not her, but I would like to be. I'd love to be that good.
Yeah. Since you brought this up, I think, you know, I know you've, I'm sure, talked about this before, and longtime readers of the series will know this, but without, like, you delve as much as you want, feel comfortable or want to, but the gender politics of this series are, how shall we say, very different than the current, maybe they're less different than the current era, but I'll let you delve into that. They're basically... Yeah. Well, flipped in a lot of ways, right?
The women were a bunch of sexist barbarians 5,000 years ago, you know. They kept their men secluded, you know, as far as they were concerned. Women ran the world. They're always having wars. They were conquering and, you know, doing all sorts of terrible stuff. The present day is supposed to be egalitarian, you know. Mm-hmm. People are supposed to all have equal rights, men and women. And, you know, do they really? Well, it depends on who you are and where you are. I was really basing it a lot on what I experienced myself when I was writing it. And, you know, some of the reviews I remember saying, this is a really good book for people to read if they want to see it from the other point of view. That is, walk a mile in my shoes. Mm-hmm. Because the reviewer is saying she's really reversed it, not in a caricatured way, but as if it actually could happen that way.
Yeah.
And because of that, I try to show, you know, there's very different sides to how you talk about equality. And the men are the ones who are struggling with it. The men are the ones who are struggling to be taken as seriously. And depending on, most people have equal rights. Some men in the most powerful royal houses are still kept in seclusion. And Bodge almost gets into trouble for talking to one of them. So it's sometimes it's a little lighthearted, but underneath that is a fairly I tried to be conscientious and I tried to treat it, seriously, but with a light touch. But yeah, the women were in charge.
Right. And so, well, this is, while you have Major Bajan, it's not, it's just coming at it from a completely different angle where, yeah, you have lines like, well, men can be good soldiers too. Your attitudes are outdated, right? And so,
Yes, right.
but I, yeah, I
Because
agree.
exactly.
It can be fun and there's definitely like funny moments, but I think, to my mind, as a man, I guess, but it's handled very well and thoughtfully, and like you said, not a caricature and not preachy, but still making a point, I think, that would be
Well, I'm glad. I'm
my
glad it
read.
worked that
Yeah.
way.
For
I didn't
sure.
start out to make a point. That's just
Yeah.
way I met. In fact, when I was a kid and I was telling these stories to a friend of mine, the boy who lived across the street, because I started making up proto versions of the stories as a girl.
Oh, really? Okay, cool.
And at one point he said to me, he said, "You realize everybody who runs things is female, is a girl." He said a girl, because I was like 10 and he was 11. He goes, "Everyone runs it's a girl." And I said, "Oh, I hadn't even realized that." I
That's
said, "But
funny.
they are. That's not going to change."
Yeah.
He was very bemused by this.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. That was another question I was going to ask. So, like we said, this is not one series, but it is one overarching world that you've built. So, just a little peek behind the curtain of, I would say a couple questions. I'll let you answer them all at once. But like, what is to you the hardest thing about writing, in this same world over and over again? And then what is the easiest or most, and or maybe it's the same thing, most fun thing about setting all these stories in one big shared universe, even if it is thousands of years difference,
Well, I think the fun part is it was just so big. I had so many different aspects. And what happened was sometime around the time, I don't know, I was two or three, I had this great epiphany, this tremendous, several epiphanies. One was that it didn't matter that I didn't understand what my father, who was a rather well-known nuclear chemist, was talking about, because someday I would learn. For me, at two or three, this was an epiphany that,
Well,
oh,
that's a
it's
yeah.
okay if you don't understand. But along with that came the epiphany that I can make up stories. And so I started to do it. And at first, they were little girls with their cats going around having adventures. As I matured, they became young women, with going places with their cats. Then one day, I realized, oh, yeah, I can have a hot fighter pilot in this. So then they were young women where, they were going to rescue the hot fighter pilot because he'd gotten into trouble. And it was always the woman was a very strong character. She was a, starship captain. She was all these things. And gradually over time, as I got older, the stories got more sophisticated. And it was just something I did as for fun, for stress relief. I instead of doing my homework, I'd listen to the radio and make up stories in my mind. I didn't actually start writing them down until graduate school. I needed a break from my thesis, which was like 300 pages of equations. So I actually started writing them down. And I started right at the point where I was imagining, which was way, way into this empire. It starts, most people think Primary Inversion was my first book, and it was, but it's in the middle of all the things that are going on. So for me, the fun is filling in all that stuff. I mean, I have huge amounts of stuff I barely touched on. The books that were published in the Scholian Empire, some of them I had worked out in detail in my mind. Primary Inversion, The Last Hawk, The Radiant Seas, Catch the Lightning. Those are all in detail worked out. Since then, I've had more. On the one hand, I haven't had the blueprint in my brain, so I had to come up with more stuff. But on the other hand, coming up with more stuff is a lot of fun. So that's certainly the enjoyable part. It is also, as I think you figured out, the most difficult part. Because I have to somehow find ways to fill in readers without getting repetitive in book after book. And I'm getting better at it than I was. You know, people used to complain. One reviewer said she plagiarizes herself. And I wrote to the people who published the review and I said, that's impossible. You can't do that. Please take that down. And they did. But I know what he was getting at. I was repeating myself in different books in the same series. So what I'm trying to do now is find new ways to introduce material. And it's not such a big deal in the major Bajan books because the main character doesn't know this stuff. So as she learns it, the reader learns it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is, again, not really about the Down Deep, which we're here to talk about, but just about the larger world. Is you mentioned you're working on the sequel to this one. And this can be kind of a process question too. Do you have a plan for like book 3-4 books down the road? Do you think you'll return to the Scullion Empire or do another major Bajan or you know, like you were saying, you know, I just started becoming interested in this. So or do you kind of like let the muse is a silly kind of word in some ways, but the muse kind of guide you, or you have plans for where you'll be taking the series or the world going forward?
Yeah, well, there's 3 books that I've been contractually signed to Bain to do.
Contract is a good muse, yeah.
Yeah. Deadlines are actually, I like deadlines because it's too easy to go, well, you know, let me just go browse the web for a while. Yeah.
Right.
It's too easy to get distracted while I'm writing. And if I have to get it out, then, you know, I do. So I'm working on the second book now. And then the third book will just be taking this a step farther. The second one I'm working on now is very much about how the wealthy above city, the city that's above the undercity, is now coming into direct and repeated contact with the undercity, you know, in the form of sports, athletics, which is often, I mean, I went to a high school where sometimes one of the only ways out or the best ways out for some students with, you know, difficult home lives was athletics.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's a good template for the meeting of these worlds. And since I'm no longer confined to one, making it a murder mystery, which it's not, and two, only telling it from Major Bajan's point of view, I can explore the different characters and get points of view from the people who come from this very wealthy civilization with the people who come from the undercity. And so it's a very different take. And my muse likes that. That fit what my muse wanted to do.
Yeah.
The third book, at this point, we'll see how the second one comes out. The third book is going to explore that more, you know, which you probably realize that already. But it's going to, you know, look more at the developments of the Dust Knights becoming known, you know, on an interstellar scale. After that, you know, there is a Scullion Empire book that I want to write. It's the follow-up to The Quantum Rose, which won the Nebula. And I have that one all worked out in my head. It's all about not the main character in The Quantum Rose, but the man. There's 2 main characters, the Kamaj and The Quantum Rose. And this member of the Ruby Dynasty named Haveril that she married. And it's all about Haveril and what his life is like after that book. So in a sense, it's a sequel to my novel that won the Nebula. But again, I'm trying to write it so you don't have to. Well, I kind of hope people will read that one. But you don't have to read the entire series.
Right. Yeah.
And other than that, I'm working on some nonfiction stuff. So.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just always curious, you know, Christopher Rocchio, who I'm seeing some parallels. It's funny. He was like, this book started out as like Batman versus the Ninja Turtles when I was a little kid. So he, like you, he's kind of been telling, you know, but he's got it planned out and the next 5 things. And so, but then other authors, you know, it sounds like maybe you're kind of somewhere in the middle. You've got plans, but you also move around as things move you. That sounds.
It varies a lot from book to book. You know, I said I had almost the whole story worked out for The Radiant Seas. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, another of my Bane books, Sunrise Alley, I literally, when I started to write that, had no clue how I was going to do it.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe that, I think that was for Bane.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a Bane
I think
book.
It was for Bane.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I don't even remember what I said in whatever, you know, I wrote to sell it to you guys. I mean, at that time, I was known well enough. I was selling stuff without detailed, you know, synopsis. But I literally had no idea what I was going to write. It came as I wrote, it came. And I'm just as happy with that one as with my other books. So I really couldn't tell you how I write, you know, how the muse moves me. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, let's. So I was going to say, what is this is sort of an interview or cheat code, but what is the question you wish I would ask about the Down Deep so that you can answer it? Is there, or worded another way, what is something you feel like the podcast audience needs to know or should know or you'd like them to know about the book?
Oh, gosh.
I guess it's kind of an interviewer cheat code.
That's all right. That's all right. Well, I really liked writing that book. It meant a lot to me because I got to explore characterization of the people that I was becoming. You know, you get to know your characters when you're writing. And after a while, you know them well, and you want to explore it and give it to your readers more. And this one let me do it because I wasn't constrained with having her solve a murder mystery. You know, I enjoyed writing those because I love puzzles, which is probably another reason Major Bajan is great at solving puzzles, because it's something I'm good at. So, you know, I know how to write that. But I had more freedom with this book, and I could explore, you know, her interactions with other people. I could explore the Dust Knights, how they interacted with each other. You know, in one of the Major Bajan books, you started to get introduced to the fact that this young man, who was essentially her second in command with the Dust Knights, he starts out not even sure he wants to join them because, you know, he doesn't know her. But gradually over the books, he becomes her second in command. And he's also the leader of a gang that protects a circle of people in the Undercity. So he's a pretty tough guy, you know, but he's also very intelligent. And through Baj as his mentor, he starts to be able to get an education because he's brilliant. I mean, he's already gotten an education to some extent himself by stealing time on, you know, the rich people's education networks. And with Baj, he starts to formalize that more. He becomes her protege. He and his wife both become her proteges. And although that was referred to in the other books, I didn't really get to develop it because I had to solve the mystery. So I think what I would like people to know about the Down Deep is it steps more into deeper into the lives of these people. And so as you get to meet them, as I develop the story, you get to meet them in a way that other stories didn't allow me to do. So that's what I like about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does have a, I guess the whole idea and why we're calling it a different series, beyond just the obvious, it's not first person and everything and not a murder mystery, but it does really feel like, even though there's a lot of Baj in it, like an ensemble, and that we're definitely launching into a wider, not a wider world, but a wider cast of characters to focus on with this one.
Yeah. And though it's the same world, we get to see it in a depth that I wasn't able to develop in some of the release parts.
Literally a depth.
Literally going down. Yes, that's it. Yeah.
I don't know. Do we want to talk about what they encounter when they get all the way down to the Down Deep? And or do we want to leave that as a titillating?
I don't know. You know, I wondered about that too.
Yeah.
I can say that they find a very desperate situation they didn't expect to encounter.
Okay.
And it has to be solved, not only for them, but for it has ramifications that extend well beyond the Down Deep and beyond the Undercity. I mean, it can affect. So they must solve this, and they have to get it done fast.
Yeah. Maybe we'll leave it there. Yeah. That. Well, we're about at our 30-minute general limit here. So, any closing thoughts? We could talk more about it, of course, but I think we don't. The thing to balance these is always we want to excite people about the books. We don't want to say so much that they don't need to buy them.
Right? Yeah, I know what you mean.
I want to feel like you've read it after you listen to us talk. So, anything? I kind of did ask the wrap up question of anything you want people to know, but. Anything else?
I think just that, this is, I used to have all my books come out in hardcover. And then, you know how the whole business changed and everything was coming out on Kindle. And for a while, they were bringing it out, my books, first in trade instead of hardcover.
Yeah.
And then you guys have always followed up with a mass market edition. This is hardcover again, which I actually didn't find out till y'all sent me the dust cover for the book. I said, "Oh, this looks like a hardcover." Well, yeah, didn't you know that? So I was very delighted, but I would like to point out that, because hardcovers do cost more than paperbacks, it is also available both in Kindle and on audio too. So people can get it, if the hardcover is too much.
Yeah.
They just don't like solid, books.
Sure.
Available in other ways.
Yeah. And of course, most people who listen to the podcast regularly know, of course, you can go to bain.com/ebooks and it's on there. And that is DRM free. So you can read it on any of your devices, the ebook there. But yes, also Amazon. And yeah, and that is something also audio. I know a lot of people love audiobooks. And so that is something we have been really working on, and Rabbit Boyette has been really pushing to get those simultaneously released with the physical and the ebooks as well. So
it works well when they can do it, which it is for the Down Deep.
Yeah. All right. Well, Catherine, thank you so much, everybody. I will say it one more time. It's the Down Deep. You got it in hardcover and ebook and audio. And of course, we'll be doing either a trade or a mass market, but you don't want to wait that long to read it. Go out and check it out now. So thank you so much, Catherine. It's been great talking to you today.
Thank you. That was a fun interview.
All right. And now we bring you our audiobook serialization of Tinker by Wynn Spencer. Inventor girl genius Tinker lives in a near future Pittsburgh, which now exists mostly in the land of the elves. She runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. When a pack of wargs chase an elven noble into her scrapyard, life as she knows it takes a serious detour. Tinker finds herself taking on the Elven Court, the NSA, the Elven Interdimensional Agency, technology smugglers, and a college-minded xenobiologist as she tries to stay focused on what's really important, her first date. Armed with an intelligence the size of a planet, steel-toed boots, and a junkyard dog attitude, Tinker is ready to kick butt to get her first kiss.
"Don't you ever sleep?" Chiyo asked peevishly. "Sometimes I do." Tinker squirmed around on her futon bed to put her feet on the wall without taking her eyes from her datapad. "Sometimes I don't," Chiyo whimpered. With the exception of the skylight, the warehouse office hadn't been set up with comfort in mind. After a few hours on the padded stool that was the office's only seat, Tinker moved back to her bedroom. Annoyingly, everything that the Oni missed when they killed her father, Riki had copied off her home system. He had made notes in a separate file, obviously trying to design a land-based gate himself. He'd gotten far enough to confirm that he had a degree of physics from Caltech, and that while gifted, was seriously out of his league. Riki had also added everything ever published on the gate since the Chinese received her father's plans from the Oni. Some of them were in original Chinese, and others had been translated, hopefully accurately. There was an entire folder on as-built drawings for the space station, the hyperphase gate, and the power systems for both. Reading over the files, it became obvious that some of her father's obscure notes relating to the Dufay Codex had been translated by an Oni familiar with both physics and magic. She was familiar with everything published after the gate was built. As Western scientists scrambled to reverse engineer the device that the Chinese seemed to produce out of thin air, she skipped them, reading only papers published in the last 3 months and making notes in a scratch file. Of the missing scientists, there was frighteningly little. She checked to see if maybe Riki loaded files and then deleted them without doing a deep scrub. She found Harry Russell's journal of his captivity. In a stunning display of iron will, he'd resisted the Oni while they whittled him down. First finger by finger of his left hand, then the hand itself, and finally his arm. They broke him too completely, and after a brief stuttering dictation as Russell fell into shock from pain, the journal ended abruptly. She scrubbed the file completely off her datapad. All the while, she pondered the seer's words, or lack of them. For the first time, she saw a certain Heisenbergian logic to the seer's silence. The act of seeing the future, thus able to avoid it, made it more unlikely that path would be taken. The seer didn't want her to deviate from some path she'd naturally take. Perhaps. It would be nice if she had some clue as to what she was supposed to be doing. Just as a straight no to the Oni wasn't the answer, as Harry Russell found out, fully cooperating with them surely couldn't be either. Finally, sick of the whole mess, she dropped her pad onto the futon and went to the window to stargaze. The moon was out and full, looking the same as Earth's, or Elf Home's. She looked for the planets that had been in conjunction the month before on Elf Home. "Stop looking out there," Chiyo moaned from her corner. "Why?" "Because it gives me a headache." "Why does my looking out a window make your head hurt?" "Because you are a stupid little fake elf, and this is a stupid waste of my abilities. I was meant for greater things than being your jailer. You'll never figure out this gate, and all my time and effort will be wasted." "Well, then let me go." Chiyo gave her a dark look. "They should just shackle you in a dank little hole and be done with it. Throw in scraps of moldy bread and let you eat cockroaches for protein. There is no reason you need to live like a princess."
"Except the whole plan depends on her," Riki said, standing at the door, his arms full of clothing.
Chiyo barked something in Oni, which got a sputtering laugh from Riki.
"Dream on, little kitsune. It's not going to happen. We're never going to be more to them than what we were created to be. Tools. You don't turn a hammer into a noble just because it hammered down a stubborn but vital nail. You either whack another nail with it, or shove it away and enjoy what you've made using it."
"A noble?" Tinker asked. So the whole Lady Chiyo was the female's desired reward for spying on Maynard and guarding her.
"Onihida is mostly feudal, with a few small bright sparks."
Riki had healing spells inked over his foot, and it looked normal, for him, but he limped as he walked, wincing in pain.
"We seem forever stuck in the Dark Ages. Nobles are usually greater blood, but occasionally a lesser blood can work its way up to a minor lord by being brutal and meticulous. Lord Tom-Tom is one. Mostly, though, lesser are tools made by the greater bloods, just like Windwolf made you."
"Windwolf changed me, but he didn't make me."
"Make, change, twist, mold. It's all the same. Here are your clothes."
He handed her the clothing. The stack contained 5 changes of panties, socks, shirts, and jeans. The underwear were silk, and the jeans were Levi's, all in her size. Behind a mask of vivid bruises, Riki's eyes were dilated into wide cerulean blue discs. If she hadn't read Russell's journal, she might have felt guilty. "I'd tell Windwolf to piss off before I'd betray a friend."
"Sometimes you get stuck in a trap of your own design."
He limped to the window to collapse onto the deep sill.
"I didn't know what Tom-Tom had done to the other scientists, just that they were dead, and they needed someone that could pass to find Dufay's son."
"Why the hell did you even get involved with them? You nearly have a doctorate of physics. Why the hell would you give it all up to be a tool on some back-ass world?"
"You wouldn't understand."
Riki fumbled through his pockets, found the MP3 player, gazed at it sadly, and put it away to pull out cigarettes. No, I don't. Nothing could make me do what you're doing.
Really?
He tapped out a cigarette, his motion slow, like he was moving through deep water.
What if someone sealed away your intelligence? Made you an idiot, but left the memories of your brilliance. At night, you'd dream that you were smart again, creating clever gadgets, having that wildfire of creativity, and wake up to find it all ashes. What would you do to get it back?
She swallowed down sudden terror. I wouldn't do this.
Liar,
Riki whispered. He clicked his tongue, and the cigarette lit. What is it that you get out of this deal?
I'm a Tengu.
He took a deep drag off the cigarette and languidly raised the hand to rest against his temple.
Hardwired in this brain is the instinct of flight. Millions of years of evolution focused on that one thing, tightly packed away.
He held out his hand, showing it innocent of feathers.
In a body that can't fly. You can't imagine, even with your marvelous brain, what an endless torture it is. Tengu don't die of old age on Earth. Sooner or later, they just climb the tallest mountain and throw themselves off, just to feel that oneness with the sky.
There's hang gliding. Riki's shoulder shook with a short, silent laugh.
Hang gliding, parachuting, high diving. I could name them all. But the thing is, you only go down. You never come back up.
You could have just gone to Elfhome. Obviously the spell works there.
When people throw themselves off mountains, normally there's not much left to salvage.
He took another long drag on his cigarette.
But we tried. We skinned the bodies of the old ones who had the tattoo, preserving them for centuries, waiting for a chance to have our wings and our freedom at the same time, slowly going mad.
But it didn't work, so you sold yourself back into slavery.
Yes,
he murmured, and then looked sharply at Chiyo.
Hey, Chiyo, you can't go to sleep.
I'm so tired,
Chiyo moaned. Riki sighed and gave a sharp whistle. The guard from the hall opened the door and looked in. Riki flicked the hand with a cigarette, giving a command in rapid Oni. The guard glanced at Chiyo, then to Tinker, nodded, and went out. What? Tinker asked.
We have a slight personnel problem. One of Chiyo's cousins was killed in a car accident. The shutdown. We missed our kill on Windwolf. It leaves us short-handed.
Things suddenly clicked for Tinker. The Oni were the smugglers. The high-tech goods were for building the gate. Chiyo's cousin must have been the pinned driver who had been shot by the other Oni, rather than let him fall into EIA hands and be questioned. Tinker looked sharply at the female. If someone had killed Oil Can, she would... She couldn't finish the thought. The possibilities of Oil Can being caught and hurt in all this was all too real for idle speculation. So, Tinker distracted herself with details. We're missing materials for the gate?
No, Lord Tom-Tom is quite methodical. We have a surplus of everything.
The door opened and the guard came back, carrying a Saijin flower. What's that for? Tinker scrambled backward, away from the guard.
It's time for you to sleep.
Riki took another drag on a cigarette and breathed the smoke out of his long, sharp nose. I don't need that. I'll sleep without it.
We have to be sure. Please, just take it nicely. With what I'm buzzing on for the pain?
He lifted his foot that she had broken.
I don't trust myself not to hurt you.
Sullenly, she held her hand for the flower, and with everyone watching closely, breathed deeply of its false comfort.
That was another installment in Wynn Spencer's Tinker, and that's it for the podcast. Thanks as always to Audible.com and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And good night, Tony Daniel, wherever you are. This is David F. Shirod coming to you from a soundproof bunker somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. Join us here next week in the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.